Being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Okay. So my name is Dr. Scott Edgington. I am substituting for Marcia Burden today, who could not be with us. And today we have a special guest from England. Dr. Lee Fletcher. Dr. Lee Fletcher is a planetary scientist and Gladstone Fellow at Oxford University. He specializes in meteorology of the outer planets, with a particular focus on infrared characterization of the giant planets, both in our solar system and beyond. He gained a PhD from Oxford for his study of Saturn's dynamics from the Cassini spacecraft. He has also worked as a NASA fellow at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. He has won the Royal Astronomical Society Award for Promising Early Career Research in 2010. So without further ado, let's hear what Lee has to say about what's going on in the atmosphere of Saturn.
Okay, thanks, Scott, for that that glowing introduction, and hello, everybody on the line. It's a pleasure to be talking to you from sunny England today, at the end of our day, but just the beginning of yours, I'm sure. So the topic I'd like to talk to you about today is one that's particularly close to my heart. It's the currently evolving storm system in Saturn's northern hemisphere. Now, if you've got the presentation open in front of you, then the very first slide of the document shows a spectacular image from the Cassini spacecraft of a bizarre-looking serpentine storm in its northern hemisphere. That's the white cloudy feature, the white cloudy phenomenon you can see to the upper left of the first Cassini image in that document. Now, I should point out that such storms are rather rare or rather unexpected in the atmosphere of Saturn. And I hope to convince you over the course of this presentation that there's a particularly special significance about this storm that's evolving and raging right as we speak. It first emerged back in December of 2010, and here we are in May of 2011, and it's still kicking up surprises. And as a meteorologist of outer planet science, this has been a fascinating few months to watch this storm as it continues to evolve. What I'm going to do is talk you through this set of about 26 slides, and I shall try to remember to tell you to change slide each for each transition. So if you now move on to slide number 2 in the presentation, I'm going to start by trying to justify why one might be interested in studying the weather systems of these giant planets. Now, when you look at Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune using visible light, what you're seeing is light that's being reflected and scattered from the uppermost clouds within the atmospheres of these giant planets. Now, that diagram on the right-hand side gives you an idea of what the temperature structure of these atmospheres is, going from the warm interior of the planet. As you move further and further up, you get to a cold minimum in the temperature structure that we know as the tropopores. And this tropopause separates the deeper troposphere from the more stable and usually much quieter upper atmosphere that we know as the stratosphere. Now, on the giant planets of our solar system, and specifically Jupiter and Saturn, the uppermost cloud deck that one can see if you look through a telescope, we believe to be clouds of ammonia ice. Okay. Now, this ammonia ice tends to shield the interior dynamics of these planets from view. It acts like a veil that hides all the mysterious inner workings of the planet from our methods of investigation. Now, spacecraft like Cassini and ground-based telescopes across the world have come up with innovative techniques to try and peer through these clouds, but the way we really get to grips with what's going on beneath is by looking at how the clouds change with time. And that's why a storm of this particular type is so important to us, because not only is it a beautiful and complex phenomenon that everybody can look at, but also it tells us something about what's happening deeper down inside the planet, and that's crucial to us as planetary scientists. Now, what we believe is taking place with these storms is that something is stirring deep down within the water cloud, and in that diagram you can see that we believe water condenses maybe 200 or 300 kilometers deeper down than the ammonia cloud deck. So we're really probing a long way into the planet when we see fantastic structures like we're seeing right now. And one of the things that I like to point out to people whenever they ask is that we're taking an object, a beautiful object like Saturn, which many of us remember from childhood as being a fantastic thing to look at through a telescope, and we're moving it into the realm of meteorology, of weather physics, and applying what we know from looking at the clouds outside of our window today to the storm systems that are emerging up on Saturn. Now, if you head to slide number 3, you can see a comparison of a global map of Jupiter with a global map of Saturn. And these are both Cassini images, just reprojected in this way. Obviously, as soon as you look at Jupiter, you're struck by the incredible banded system of white zones and darker belts with huge vortices like the Great Red Spot lurking down there in the southern hemisphere. If you compare that to Saturn, things look a lot more bland. It looks a lot more placid. But what we're beginning to understand about the deep interior atmosphere of Saturn is that there's the potential there for gigantic outbursts of cloud material, for huge thunderstorm complexes to develop to redistribute energy throughout the atmosphere. So although Saturn might look placid, it's actually a bit deceiving. We've got this thick layer of haze and cloud that's simply hiding all that wonderful meteorology from our view. And it's only when an eruption of this type takes place that we can really get to grips with what's happening down at depth. Now, if you head to slide number 4, I want to give you a quick overview of the methodology we would use for studying a storm of this type. It's not simply a case of taking a lot of beautiful images and trying to interpret them. Actually, what we're doing is we're using a whole suite of what we call remote sensing instruments on board the Cassini spacecraft. And these are things that I've highlighted on the far left of the Cassini diagram just here. You can see the familiar shape of the high-gain antenna up at the top and the thrusters down at the bottom of the diagram. But on the left, you see a whole palette of rather complicated-looking instruments. And these measure the light all the way from the ultraviolet at energies that are higher than the visible radiation we normally see out into the far infrared at much, much lower energies. By measuring that spectrum of light, we can work out the vertical structure, the composition, and the distribution of clouds that are associated with this storm. Now, just before we move on, I've also highlighted another instrument on the right-hand side of this diagram. That's called the RPWS, the Radio and Plasma Wave Science Instrument. And that's going to become important later on, because as well as seeing the different wavelengths of light using that remote sensing platform, we're also able to hear the crackle of the thunderstorms as they're erupting down there on Saturn. And in fact, it was the RPWS instrument on board Cassini that first gave us a hint that something was lurking and something was forming down there in the depths of Saturn's stormy atmosphere. Now, if you head to slide number 5, this will give you an overview of how we use those spectroscopic remote sensing observations. Starting from the far left, with the models that we have, we can take a variety of images at any wavelength of light that we can possibly measure, combine it with spectroscopy, both from orbiting spacecraft like Cassini or Galileo before that, or spaceborne telescopes. And in the bottom, you can see an image of the Spitzer telescope, which has really helped us to understand some of the data that we have on Saturn. And we can combine all of those different wavelengths of light using the blue boxes in the center just there. Now, that's a suite of software, of computing code, that we use to try to synthesize how light interacts with the atmosphere of these giant planets. And by synthesizing how that interaction occurs, we can start to peel back the various layers to understand the physics and the chemistry of these atmospheres that are responsible for producing the particular spectrum of light that we see. And on the far right, in those green boxes, it gives you just a hint at some of the things that are affecting that spectrum. The weather of the giant planets is affecting that spectrum. The chemistry that it's occurring high up above the cloud tops and forming long chain molecules that then emit infrared light and are detected by Cassini, that will affect the spectrum. And you can even make a case, because the materials that are present on Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus and Neptune have been locked away in these planets for eons and eons since the very early stages of our solar system, you can begin to see that by measuring the composition of these planets, it's like opening a window on the deep, distant past of our solar system and trying to figure out what the composition of the solar nebula was back at the time when these giant planets formed. So by using these remote sensing techniques, it's an extremely powerful method of diagnosing the physics and chemistry of these gas giant atmospheres. If you move to slide number 6, the final diagram I want to show you before we start talking about the storms gives you an idea of what I meant by the spectrum of light from these two planets. On the top there, you have a spectrum, a synthetic spectrum, from Saturn, and in the bottom you have one similar size of spectrum from the atmosphere of Jupiter. On the far left, and this is highlighted by the red box, you can see a very smooth undulating spectrum. There's not a lot of features there, and this spectrum is formed by the hydrogen and helium, which we know to make up the bulk of the atmosphere of Saturn and Jupiter. By measuring and by reproducing that smooth continuum spectrum, we can use it like a thermometer, almost like sticking your finger in the air and taking the temperature. That's our thermometer for measuring the temperature of these giant planets. Now, superimposed onto that smoothly varying continuum is a whole host of other features. You get sharp spikes which stick upwards. These are emission features of molecules high in Saturn and Jupiter's atmospheres that are emitting infrared light that are then detected by our telescopes. These are highlighted by the purple boxes, and we use these as another type of thermometer, but this time for measuring temperatures very, very high in the atmosphere. And finally, we also see what we call absorption features, or dips in the spectrum, and those are highlighted by the green box. So by combining all of these different things together, we're able to measure the temperature, we're able to determine the abundance of all of the different gases that are there within these atmospheres, and we're also able to study the cloud distributions on these planets. So we try to combine all of these different pieces of information into a study of how Saturn's atmosphere is evolving in time. Now, if you switch to slide number 7, this shows a view on the left and the right of Saturn early in the Cassini mission versus one that was taken in early 2009, I believe. Now, you can see there's been a huge change in how this planet appears, and most of that change is occurring because Saturn experiences seasons, just like we do here on Earth. In fact, Cassini first arrived at Saturn when the southern hemisphere was undergoing summertime conditions, balmy temperatures of maybe 80 degrees Kelvin in the troposphere, which is quite a way below zero compared to what we're normally used to. You can see that the shadow created by the planet has changed in its orientation over time. So whereas the southern hemisphere was pointed at the sun back in 2004, when we got through to 2009, the whole disk of the planet was illuminated. And this we call northern springtime, when the northern hemisphere is starting to emerge into sunlight conditions again. And by changing the amount of light that's falling into this atmosphere, you start to see that the cloud colors and the temperature distributions are actually changing over the course of time. What I want to give you the impression of is that all of this is happening relatively slowly. We've got 6 years now of data, or near continuous data, of how Saturn's atmosphere changes in response to this altering sunlight conditions. And nothing has really been spectacular in the sense of a large eruption like this before. We've seen the temperature changing, we've seen the cloud colors changing, but this is all happening over yearly and even decadal timescales. Now, that slow seasonal evolution was then disrupted by the emergence of that giant storm back in 2010. If you head to slide number 8, I want to talk a little bit about the temperatures of the atmosphere, seeing as that's what we're going to be discussing later on when we start to look at the storm. Now, in the top right of this figure, you see an artist's impression of how Saturn's rings, or the ring plane, opens up to us over the course of time. I've marked on approximately where we are today, with the northern hemisphere coming into sunlight. And then right down at the bottom of the figure, you can see what Saturn's ring plane will look like towards 2017. And that's about the time when the Cassini spacecraft, the end of the Cassini mission, will be approaching us. So we can build up this large data set over the course of time. Now, we've done so already if you look at the panels on the far left of this figure. Now, it's a little bit of a complicated diagram, but the way to read this is that the blue points in this diagram were taken very early in the mission, and the red points in the diagram were taken more recently in 2009 and 2010. The diagram goes from the South Pole on the right to the North Pole on the left and shows you how the temperature varies as we go from the southern summer hemisphere into the northern winter hemisphere. You can just about see that the southern hemisphere is starting to cool down as autumn approaches, as the fall approaches, and that the spring hemisphere is starting to warm up. Well, no surprises there, you might say. And in fact, in the bottom right of that diagram, of this particular slide number 8, you can see that we can actually model how the temperatures are expected to vary with time over the course of the coming few years. All we need to know is the amount of sunlight that's falling into the atmosphere and the distribution of the various gases that are present just there in order to make this prediction. You can see that around about 2004, when Cassini first arrived, perhaps unsurprisingly, you had a warm southern hemisphere and a cold northern hemisphere because we were in the southern summertime conditions. Then through to 2009, around about the middle of that diagram, those temperatures are starting to even themselves out. And in fact, we can predict, and I hope that we're eventually proven right, that towards 2017 and 2018, that seasonal asymmetry in temperatures, where you have a hot south and a warm and a cold north, will actually have flipped itself in response to these seasons. So everything's happening very slowly over the course of a few years and in a predictable fashion, so long as we understand the chemistry of this particular atmosphere. If you shoot to slide number 9, you can see that some things happen rapidly. We do see these convective storms cropping up every now and then, creating a bright splash of colour in an otherwise fairly serene cloud deck. And these include things like the Dragon Storm, which emerged in 2004 and was one of the first big features that Cassini focused its cameras and its infrared instruments on to try and look for various phenomena associated with that Dragon Storm. And also in the bottom of slide number 9, you can see that certain latitudes are very prone to storm activity. And you get these tiny dark and light spots in certain latitude bands, which are signifying convective activity, rather like a bubbling saucepan, if you like, with material being brought up from depth and deposited high up in the atmosphere, like bubbles rising in a fluid. We've also detected the flashes from lightning strikes, so we know that thunderstorms occur on this planet. But if you look at some of these images, you can see they're small in scale. There's nothing that quite rivals the image that I showed you on the first slide of this presentation. Now, if you head to slide number 10, we'll start talking about the storm and about the discovery of the storm by Cassini and the eventual tracking of this storm by amateur observers. One of the reasons I love doing this particular subject is because it's so accessible to the amateur community to work with us as planetary scientists to help us build that continuous record of storm events on Saturn. Now, the radio and plasma wave instrument I told you about earlier was the first to detect a sign that something was stirring deep within the atmosphere of the planet. It could hear the crackling of the radio waves that were associated with lightning strikes within the planet. But what RPWS cannot do is create a nice image which tells you exactly where this storm is or how to pinpoint what latitude the storm is taking place at. That has to wait for the amateur observers. And these amateurs are extremely talented with a fantastic amount of kit, and they were able to pinpoint exactly where an outbreak of a storm was taking place. And initially, it just looked like a very faint white spot, and it was only over the ensuing weeks that we realized that something special was taking place. In fact, the white spot began to expand rather rapidly, and Saturn's rather rapid eastwardly and westward flowing winds started to shear the material out east and west. And if you look at the bottom images, these are Cassini images from December the 24th, from Christmas Eve last year, you can see that the storm had got a bulbous oval-like head of bright cloud material. And then downstream to the right-hand side, these undulating patterns of cloud activity, of wave activity that was being pushed around by Saturn's winds that were whipping east and west. And in fact, using the amateur data in combination with the Cassini data, we could measure the rate at which all these features were moving, and we found that they were basically moving with the background flow, so nothing particularly unexpected there. They were literally being pushed around by Saturn's winds. So you might ask, well, why is this significant then? And on slide 11, I give you a shot that was observed by the Hubble Space Telescope back in 1990, which shows the last event of any similar scale that was measured in Saturn's atmosphere. Now, this one happened at the equator rather than in the northern hemisphere. And this was about 20 years ago, back in 1990, before Cassini ever got to Saturn and before we had the sophisticated detector technology here on Earth to really study this storm in any great detail. In fact, all of the studies that took place back in the 90s used the reflected sunlight portion of the spectrum only, rather than the large, broad infrared spectrum that I was showing you a few slides ago. So what's so special about this storm? Well, records go back to about 1876, and this is only the sixth time that any huge white disturbance has actually been recorded. Now, when people looked at the dates of these disturbances, and they're common to northern mid-latitudes and to the equatorial region, they seem to be happening approximately once every 30 years or so. And that 30-year cadence coincided with summertime conditions up there in the northern hemisphere. Now, if that had been the case, if you look at 1990 and you think, well, Saturn's year is approximately 30 years long, that means we wouldn't have expected another storm of this magnitude until 2020 or so. So we were extremely surprised and extremely grateful when a storm erupted much earlier in the seasonal cycle than usual, and Cassini was there in orbit around Saturn, able to take the measurements that it's taken. So here we are in northern springtime right now, whereas we didn't expect a storm to occur until northern summertime. So there's something significant about this early onset of the storm. And the fact that this is only the sixth disturbance to be recorded means that of this particular generation, this may be the only one that we get to see. The next one won't be scheduled until sometime in 2040 or 2050, which I sincerely hope most of us are around to see, but you never know. You head to slide number 12 now. You get some of the Cassini images of this spectacular storm in its mature phase. So it broke out on December 5th, and amateurs tracked it over the ensuing few weeks and saw it begin to evolve and spread east and west. But these images, I think, are quite spectacular because they show how this serpent-like storm, this snake-like storm, took on almost a cometary-like appearance. You could almost imagine it hurtling from right to left on your screen with its bulbous head down there in the left of these images. Now, all of that chaotic structure you can see east and west is turbulence being developed, being generated by this storm. And within those turbulent eddies and turbulent circulating flows, we saw the development of a large oval-like system, and that's what's shown in the blue image on the top left of this slide. Now, that swirling storm was about 4,000 or 5,000 kilometers across, so an extremely large storm, and one which might grow over the course of the coming months to develop into a much larger storm system, one of the largest that we've seen in Saturn's atmosphere. But it's within this turbulent region, so nobody really knows. This is happening with over short time periods, but with a chaotic dynamics which could dissipate all that energy and mean that that oval disappears over the course of time. So it's one of those amazing systems that we need to study to understand how these ovals survive and how they're maintained within Saturn's atmosphere. But I think the main reason for me showing you this slide number 12, is to show just how spectacular Cassini's imaging of this gigantic storm has been. Now, contrast that, if you will, if you go to slide number 13. Now, this is where I've come into the story, if you like, because most of my research is based on infrared observations rather than visible observations. And the reason I use the infrared is because you can do things like measure the temperature, measure the composition, and measure the cloud distributions that are associated with this storm. Now, the images on slide 13 were taken not by Cassini, but by the Very Large Telescope down in Chile. Now, these are a system, they're a complex of four large 8-meter diameter telescopes that sit high above the Earth's water vapor in the Atacama Desert down in Chile. I actually only use one of those telescopes. The other three have different instruments on them that look at very different things, ranging from distant cosmology to the physics and chemistry of our own solar system. But one particular instrument is capable of taking infrared images at a variety of different wavelengths, and those I'm showing in the top panel compared to a amateur observation on the far left, which shows what this looked like on January the 19th of this year in visible light. Now, if you look at the images that are at 18.7 and 10.7 microns, these images are sensitive to the deep weather layer of Saturn's atmosphere, what we call the troposphere. And you can see small features, small changes in contrast. If you see dark features, that means it's cold. If you see warm features, if you see bright features, that means it's warm. And those temperature contrasts are all associated with the bubbling motion, the convective and turbulent motion that's taking place within this storm system. But most surprising and most importantly are the images at 8.6 and 12.3 microns. So this is the one in the center and the one on the far right. Now, instead of being sensitive to the weather layer, where all the turbulence is expected to take place, these are sensitive to the much higher region of the atmosphere that we call the stratosphere. And this is the region of the atmosphere that normally is very stable. You don't expect a lot of turbulence or motion. In fact, planes that fly here on the Earth will fly high up in the upper troposphere and lower stratosphere just to get away from this sort of turbulence so that they're not buffeting their passengers on their journeys. So normally, when we look at these wavelengths, we don't see very much structure. So we were quite surprised then when on January the 19th, the VLT took these images to show the spectacular hot spots that you see both at 12.3 and at 8.6 microns up in the northern hemisphere. Now, just to give you an idea of what this means that a storm deep down within Saturn's weather layer, down in the cloud tops and below, is having an effect hundreds of kilometers higher up in the stratosphere of this planet. And I don't think anybody expected such a large perturbation to occur because of a tropospheric storm. And we'll get back to this in a few slides' time. But if I talk about stratospheric beacons or stratospheric hotspots, I want you to keep these images in mind. Why do I call them beacons? Well, if you have this planet rotating once every 10 hours, these hotspots will be coming into view with a 10-hour period. And in fact, later images showed that these hotspots were so bright that they completely outshone the rest of the planet at these wavelengths. So it was like Saturn had got a lighthouse, like a beacon was flashing up there in the darkness due to this gigantic storm that had taken place in Saturn's atmosphere. Now, if you head to slide number 14, this gives you an idea of how Cassini measures the infrared radiation from those storm features. Now, the top left shows very, very crude maps that were obtained by the composite infrared spectrometer. This was one of the instruments on the remote sensing platform we spoke about earlier. It doesn't just take images. What it does is it stares at a particular latitude of the planet as the planet then rotates beneath. And, of course, the planet rotates once every 10 hours, and so it takes 10 hours to get just one latitude circle of your map. If you're very lucky, that map will then cut through some of the thermal structures we saw on the previous slide. It will cut through those stratospheric beacons and the cold and hot spots that we saw deeper down within the atmosphere. And in fact, if you look at the plots on January the 2nd of this year and January the 19th of this year, you can see those two hot stratospheric beacons that were glowing in the infrared when we looked at them with the VLT, the telescope out in Chile. But the crucial difference between using a telescope in Chile and using the spectrometer on Cassini is that Cassini is able to measure the full spectrum, that whole spectrum of light that I showed you a few slides ago. Now, by modeling that spectrum using the techniques that we described earlier on, we're able to measure the temperature structure both with latitude and with longitude, and crucially, to measure how that temperature has changed with time in response to the storm system. And that's what I'm doing in the bottom two panels, where you can see that very blue colours mean it's very cold, and very red or orange colours mean that it's very warm, higher up in the stratosphere. Now, if you take the difference between the temperatures I measured in January compared to the temperatures I measured the previous October, so before the storm actually took place, then you get the plots that I'm showing in slide 15. Now, plot A on the top left shows the difference in temperature as you go from north to south. You can see that over the center of the storm, we have very cold temperatures, whereas in the regions flanking the storm, we have very hot temperatures. And the way we try to explain this is that imagine you have a rising column of gas. That gas then expands. You may remember from high school physics that if you expand a gas, it cools down. And that's what we believe we're seeing here. You've got a rising column over the central disturbance of this storm system that's expanding and cooling down. Now, you also remember that whatever goes up must come down. And those hot spots either side of the cold region are due to that air then being compressed and sinking back down into the atmosphere. So you have, again, the saucepan analogy is a good one. You have rising air in the center and descending air in the branches surrounding the central disturbance, causing those hot beacons that we see in the infrared images. Now, I've got temperature differences on the left, which are north to south, and on the right, that are east to west. But in the bottom two panels, what I've tried to display is the fact that these temperature changes have a huge effect on the motions that are taking place within Saturn's atmosphere. So it's not a static atmosphere. You've got extremely powerful winds whipping east and west. And what this storm is doing is then adding a vertical component. It's adding a vertical upthrust to the dynamics that's taking place. And in fact, those temperature changes have served to accelerate the winds that we see high up in the atmosphere. So they're now zipping even faster east and west than they ever were before. And in fact, we can measure how far the material must have moved upwards and downwards in order to create the temperature fields that we see. And in fact, over the storm itself, that rising motion must have pushed the atmosphere upwards by 20 to 25 kilometers. Now, if you compare that with the height of the clouds that you see out of your window today, which are only a few kilometers above the ground, you can see that this is a fairly intense motion that's moved this material or redistributed the material within Saturn's atmosphere. So by using these different temperature measurements, we can tell a lot about the dynamics that's taking place. And crucially, rather than just looking at visible images of the cloud tops, what we're doing is we're introducing a vertical dimension. We're measuring the effect of the storm hundreds of kilometers further up within Saturn's atmosphere. And that's something that we've never been able to do before, and the presence of Cassini in orbit has allowed us to do for the first time. Now, if you go to slide 16, I'm basically repeating what I've just said here. Slide 16 shows those thermal contrasts down in the troposphere again, showing you the development in the top left of the large oval that we saw within Saturn's atmosphere, that oval that had formed in the turbulent region of the tail of this large storm. And you can see the oval appears slightly dark in visible light, that's panel C in this figure, but cold at thermal wavelengths, at wavelengths that are sensitive to the temperature, the thermometer we spoke about earlier. And again, we can understand this if we think of a rising column of air expanding and cooling down. So we know that this newly formed oval there in the troposphere of this planet is extremely cold. Now, the temperature contrasts are causing those jet streams that we spoke about, the ones that are zipping east and west, to meander up and down with latitude. And they can possibly even form a closed loop, which is what we think is happening with this storm, which is with the oval, I apologize. We think that the meandering jet streams, in response to those temperature changes, have caused a closed loop to develop. And that closed loop masquerades itself as this new oval that's formed in Saturn's northern hemisphere. And in the very bottom of this figure, you can see another spectacular high-resolution image taken by the Cassini spacecraft. And these are raw images from Cassini that have been stitched together to show the chaotic structures and that newly formed oval in Saturn's troposphere. Now, if you head to slide 17, slide 17 shows that we've actually been able to track these bright stratospheric features over the course of the last few months. Of course, as soon as we saw that there was something unusual taking place within Saturn's atmosphere, we wrote a series of telescope proposals to the Very Large Telescope in Chile, asking them to devote a little bit of time each night to tracking the location of these features. They were so unexpected and such new features that we thought we'd better try to understand what is taking place and what's actually happening with those. Now, the chain of images in the bottom of slide 17 show that we continued to detect these images from these hot features from the ground all the way through January and February. But this is a rather old slide now, and it's been superseded slightly by slide 18, which is the next one, which shows that the Cassini spacecraft has been able to track the location of these features with time. And this is hot off the press. Nobody has seen this yet. The hot beacons, there were two of them when we first started making our measurements of the storm. And in the top left, the chart shows the location of those features in longitude over the course of time since December 5th when the storm first broke out. Well, we started to realize that one of the beacons was traveling much faster in longitude than the other one. So one was actually racing to catch up with its slower cousin, and eventually, by extrapolating those lines, we realized that the two beacons would come into contact with one another. Now, remember I said that these beacons are regions where the atmosphere is sinking and heating up. We're squeezing air together and causing the temperature to rise. If those two beacons come into contact, that will reinforce that sinking motion, make it even stronger. And in fact, if you look at the series of figures on the right of this diagram, you can see how these beacons came closer and closer and closer together, and eventually, down there on the 26th of April 2011, the two beacons merged. And the reason that you've got the strong red color in that diagram is because temperatures rose nearly 60 degrees above the ambient surroundings. Imagine if I were to take the temperature in your room right now and raise it by 60 degrees. It would be a stunning change. And this gigantic change in Saturn's atmosphere is the biggest we've ever detected in all the years we've looked at Saturn in the thermal infrared. This is something that we still don't fully understand, but is happening right now, and we're continuing to track the evolution of this hot stratospheric feature using both Cassini and the Very Large Telescope down in Chile. Now, if you move to the next slide, we've been focusing so far on the temperature structure, on the temperature and the winds that we know we can measure with the SEERS instrument on Cassini. But VIMS, which is the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer, has also been taking spectra at a slightly different wavelength of light. And these wavelengths are sensitive to light being scattered from the cloud tops again. But different wavelengths are sensitive to very different things. And what we've done in the left of this image is combine three different wavelengths to give you an idea of what's going on. Now, the red color here is sensitive to large particles that are scattering light at 4 microns or so. So we know that over the storm, we have larger particles than over the rest of Saturn's atmosphere. The green color denotes clouds at very high altitude, and the blue color denotes absorption due to ammonia ice. So taking all those things together, we see that the storm has got an abundance of large particles and a large amount of fresh ammonia ice. Now, if you remember what we said earlier about the upwelling taking place over the storm, dredging material from deep within the planet and raising it up to altitudes that we're able to then measure it using the instruments on Cassini, this is all very consistent. We're showing that ice is forming as a strong, powerful updraft of ammonia then condenses out all these crystals of ice to form the white clouds that we can then see in Saturn's atmosphere. So this is all very consistent with the idea of a bubbling saucepan, a motion that rises material from the deep atmosphere and then sinks over those hot beacons in regions flanking the central upwelling. if you go to slide 20, just very, very quickly, I'd like to show that if you measure the distribution of various chemicals in Saturn's atmosphere, as well as ammonia, you're able to, again, convince yourself that powerful upwelling is taking place. Now, if you just focus on panel A for a second, the black dots there were taken in October, and the crosses were taken in January. You can see that there's a huge difference between the two, right over the location where the storm is taking place. And that difference is being caused by air that is depleted in a particular gas called acetylene being pushed upwards. So when we detect it, we see a reduced amount of acetylene at a particular altitude. Again, without going into the details, this is all consistent with that convective overturning motion. Just in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to slide 21, which shows that actually the story doesn't really end there. The powerful upwelling in the center is just one facet of this amazing storm. In fact, downstream to the east of the central upwelling, you have a series of undulating features. There are dark features and brighter white features downstream. Now, those are coincident with temperature changes as well. And what we believe is happening is that you have a wave of atmospheric motion whereby if you have air rising upwards and cooling, the cooling temperatures will then cause ammonia to condense and to form puffy white clouds. And then if you go to the trough of the wave, you have air sinking, heating up, and causing that ice to then evaporate or to sublimate and to disappear from our view. So the wave motion is then causing that beautiful cloud formation in the peaks and the troughs of the wave in a way rather analogous to if you look at a mountain and you see clouds rippling over the top of the mountain and forming wave activity downstream within the flow. That's another good example of something that we now know from Earth-based meteorology directly applicable to the atmosphere of Saturn and these incredible structures that we see there in Saturn's atmosphere. So what have we learned? If we go to slide 22, this is an attempt to try and draw together all the things we've talked about so far. Point number one suggests that we have an upwelling plume of material, and that plume is dredging things like ammonia, things like the gas called phosphine, from deep within Saturn's atmosphere and raising up to the level of the clouds. Now, when it gets to the altitude at which those species will start to condense, they form ice crystals, and those ice crystals are what's reflecting the sunlight that we see when we look at visible images of the planet. Now, the adiabatic expansion, and what I mean by that is that the expansion of the air after it's risen to the cloud tops will then cause that to look much colder than the surroundings. And if you look back to when we looked at the temperature maps, you remember that the disturbance itself looks cold. And it's those temperature contrasts which are causing the changes to the winds which zip east and west around Saturn's atmosphere. If we move higher and higher up into what we normally think of as the stably stratified, the much more quiescent region of Saturn's atmosphere, we're at a level now where we don't expect any effects from such a weather layer storm, 300 kilometers higher above the cloud tops. But what we've shown is that this tropospheric storm has perturbed temperatures and changed the distribution of material and the distribution of energy within these stratospheric altitudes 300 kilometers above the cloud decks. And in fact, they generated something which we'd never seen before, what we've termed stratospheric beacons, which have then gone on to merge together to reinforce themselves and are still evolving as we speak now and will be tracked over the coming months using telescopes and using the Cassini spacecraft. Slide 23 says that actually we don't understand the whole story yet, and why should we? We've only been looking at this for 6 months or so. Why now? Why has this storm erupted at this particular point in the seasonal cycle? Why do they always seem to be clustered around northern summertime or northern springtime? And why do we never see a storm of this magnitude when the southern hemisphere is going through similar seasonal temperature changes? We were there, Cassini was there in orbit around Saturn during southern summer, and yet nothing of this magnitude was observed. So the question is, what then is the difference between the northern hemisphere of Saturn and the southern hemisphere of Saturn? based on all we understand, these two things should be roughly symmetric. There is a very slight difference in the amount of energy that falls into the atmosphere in southern summertime compared to northern summertime, but is that energy change enough to cause this bizarre asymmetry between north and south? And this is something we will have to model over the coming years to try to understand why this is taking place. The other question is, why is this particular latitude, and the storm in this occasion is up at 40 degrees north, why does that seem to be more prone to these outbreaks than other latitudes on Saturn? And we believe we understand that the jets that are moving westward within Saturn's atmosphere, they seem to be more prone to instabilities that grow, develop, and cause these storms to persist for long timescales. But our understanding of that is in its very early days, and we will have to do many more observations before we can really pin down why this latitude appears to be special in this atmosphere. And finally, how did this occur? Well, we believe we have a handle now on this being a storm that started down in the water clouds, 300 kilometers deeper than those upper cloud decks that we normally see. But we still don't really know why this happened at this particular moment in time. What happened to create this huge plume which rose up from the water cloud deck to deposit material at the altitudes that we could then see? So for a planetary scientist, it's a particularly exciting time to try and figure out what's going on. And in fact, if you look at slide 24, this is one of the most recent views that Cassini has got of this evolving storm system. You can see that now it has spread east and west over the entire latitude circle in Saturn's northern hemisphere and left in its wake chains of wave features, of small vortices, of light and dark colors. And in fact, we know that these temperatures are hugely variable as you go around the latitude circle. And what we're expecting to see is that this storm will have an after effect that could be measurable for some time to come. And we're very lucky that Cassini is still there to guide us through the rest of this process over the coming few years. So just to wrap up, on slide 25, other conclusions that I think I'd like you to take home from this this rather rapid run-through of Saturn's storm activity. We've got a spectacular storm, the chance of a generation to see it right now, being tracked by Cassini and a whole host of ground-based observatories around the world as we try to get to grips with what is taking place in Saturn's springtime hemisphere. By using thermal infrared light from both Cassini and from the ground-based telescopes, we're able to understand the vertical structure of the storm for the first time. And by doing so, we can now drag Saturn, kicking and screaming, into a realm of terrestrial, of Earth-based meteorology to try and understand how the physics we understand from storm clouds on Earth is directly applicable to these storm clouds on Saturn. And then finally, by looking at these evolving storm systems, both on Saturn and on Jupiter and on all the giant planets in our solar system, we can get a handle on the processes working much, much deeper down to try and understand the region of the atmosphere that we can't see using the instruments on Cassini, but we can infer what's taking place down at these dark, murky depths within the giant planet interior. So Saturn's storm is a godsend for us. It's a paradise for us to be able to understand the meteorology of these giant planets. And I think with that, with 10 minutes to go, I'll leave it there and I will open it up to any questions from you guys that you might have.
Well, thank you, Lee. This was a great introduction to the storm and very detailed. Some truly exciting stuff happening there. I have to say, I went out to dinner with one of the amateur astronomers, Anthony Wesley, when he was visiting here. And I have to say, the amateur community is really excited about observing these storms and contributing to the historical record that that is being collected in all this. They truly appreciate the professionals, you know, helping the professionals out in observing these storms and other Saturn phenomena.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing, especially with Jupiter's atmosphere as well. These guys are very dedicated. They have a lot of their own time that they devote to this sort of study. And it's time that, I mean, we simply couldn't apply for days and days of time on ground-based observatories and on things like Cassini. There just isn't enough hours in the day, if you like, to track these things. So by having these talented guys spread around the world, we get a near continuous record of what's taking place. We work very closely with them now. We've learned that they're often the ones to make these startling discoveries, and then it's the job of the professional to try and explain what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So are there any questions online for Lee?
Yeah, this is Lynn from the Netherlands, so almost the same time zone.
Okay.
I had a question about the mergers. I was wondering, is this something you expected, or is it typical that two storms like that would merge? Do you see that happening on Jupiter or on the Earth, or was this something that was unexpected?
Yeah, so the merger is taking place, or took place, high in the atmosphere of Saturn, which is a region that we don't normally observe. And it's the same is true on Jupiter. We don't normally see these upper levels. We normally look at what's going on deeper down in the cloud deck. Now, storms on Jupiter have been observed to merge before. And in fact, it was the merger of two or three white ovals back in the early 2000s that led to the generation of something we call the Little Red Spot, or Oval BA, on Jupiter. So these aren't unprecedented phenomena. But the difference is this time is that we're measuring a very high altitude effect. And I wouldn't say it was expected, but if we'd have looked more carefully at the infrared images that we got in the first place, we would have noticed that the two beacons of light were at very slightly different latitudes. And we know that different latitudes have different wind speeds zipping east and west. And so we might have been able to predict that such a merger would have taken place. But at the time, we were so excited about the beacons actually being there that we weren't thinking that far ahead into the future. But yes, it looks like we're beginning to understand what actually took place.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
sure. For the rest, I think I need some time to digest it all. Probably tomorrow I'll have some questions, but not today.
Oh, by all means, feel free to contact me afterwards. I realize that there's a lot to take in here because we don't fully understand what's taken place yet, but we're trying to piece it together bit by bit. And these beacons were completely new to us. They were a complete surprise.
Any other questions?
Yes, this is Jason Kendall in New York City. I was just looking at slide 24 for the ISS view on May 15th, and
okay.
I noticed that it's partially dark and partially bright. It's like half dark, half bright. And I do public outreach in New York, and I had my 15-inch telescope out with an 8mm, so it was about 200 power, looking at it visually last night.
Right.
And the dark band is actually extended across the entire face. So it's all dark. I couldn't distinguish a dark and bright area, and I had about three or four people there with me who also confirmed that, too.
So you're talking east and west here?
Yeah, that's correct. East-west.
Okay.
The east-west extent was all dark. I tried to see if I could see something that was, like, brighter than it, and at 200 power, it had a little bit of wind, so it was a little bit of a trick. But
right.
It did look distinctly darker, and, I mean, the precision, the skies were steady enough, I was able to see the Cassini division with ease.
Right, okay.
So I think, I don't know if there's been any... It seems like it just got... Because I was looking at your images, and they seem to be brighter than the surface area, but this seemed darker. And
well, don't forget that there is a little bit of processing that takes place with these images. You're
right.
Taking it in certain filters and then combining them together to make an RGB image.
Right.
So that
the
might...
The visual is going to be very different. Of course it will be, yeah. But it's interesting. That was something that was of great interest. And in fact, anybody who's doing public outreach really should use this as an opportunity. That's what I did last night in New York City. So... it's a fantastic opportunity.
I absolutely agree with you. I mean, to be able to explain that what people are seeing is a raging storm on Saturn, I think, can blow people's minds. It's quite impressive.
That's what everybody up on the hilltop thought last night.
Great.
So, Lee, do we know how far this storm has wrapped around? planet?
Well, actually,
I mean, is that covering, you know, like two-thirds of the planet?
It's the whole way around now. The
whole way around, okay.
The head met the tail back in the end of February this year. So ever since, it's been evolving as one complete system. It's the entire latitude band that is now the storm, if you like. There is still a discrete storm head. So if you remember the early images that looked a bit like a comet, the bit on the far left, the brightest bit, we call the storm head. That is still faintly visible as a slight perturbation, which is why I was interested in the last gentleman from New York City who was explaining he couldn't see any contrast from east to west. And that could mean he was just looking at the tail region of the storm, but it could also mean that the head is finally slowing down and is not quite as readily visible from Earth yet. What we really need is some more Cassini images to take a look at the fine scale structure to see whether the upwelling is still taking place now.
Well, on that note, in a few weeks, we'll be having an intense observation campaign of Saturn. So hopefully the storm will still be raging and we could, you know, take many, many images and lots of spectra and determine how this thing is evolving.
Yeah, it'd be fantastic, definitely.
Any other questions?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Do you have any idea what ultimately is powering the upwelling? What is powering the storm?
That's a really good question. When you think about storms here on Earth, what we're talking about is the sun's energy heating up the surface of the planet and then powering a convective column like a thunderstorm, for example. But of course, on Saturn, as you get down to these incredible depths, the sunlight just simply isn't penetrating down, and there is no solid surface to be heated up by the sun's rays to cause these temperature differences. On the other hand, what the giant planets do have is a source of their own, we call it internal energy. This is energy that was left over from the birth of the planets back at the dawn of the solar system. The planets themselves are very, very slowly contracting over the course of time. They're taking their potential energy and releasing it as heat energy. And that heat energy moves upwards via convection, and it's those tiny changes in heat energy from position to position which would affect the water cloud, which would then create this self-sustaining column. So the direct answer to your question is it's the internal energy of the planet which is supplying the energy to keep this storm going, rather than the changes in the sunlight. So you then might ask, well, if it's internal energy, why on earth is this a seasonal effect? You know, what makes it summertime conditions or springtime conditions when you see these large outbursts? And I think one of the best ideas or the best hypotheses for this is that the bubbling kind of convective motion is taking place all of the time on Saturn, but it's the seasonal change in the upper atmosphere that makes the columns able to rise up higher in the atmosphere. They're able to penetrate up to the levels that we can then see them. So, yeah, I think this is something happening deep down at depth where the sun's rays aren't important, but the sun's rays do affect the ability of the columns to rise up to the altitudes that we can then see them. But yeah, that's a good question and one that we're trying to get to grips with.
Okay.
Cool. So, Lee, I have a question myself. For several years, VIMS has been seeing these string of pearls around
right.
the same latitude. Has there been any attempt to try to correlate these pearls with the formation of this storm?
There certainly has. And the pearls, I can tell you, have been integral to the development of this storm. The pearls have not been viewed since this storm broke out. Well, whether that's due to the fact that they've actually gone, or whether it's because the cloud material that's been spewed up by the storm has simply stopped us from being able to see them. They've put a veil over the top of the pearls so we can no longer view them in the same way. But we do know that the pearls were changing slowly with time, and that those changes were most apparent in the months leading up to the storm. And the storm erupted in exactly the same location as that string of pearls. So the two phenomena are almost certainly connected, in some way that we need to look back through the data to really pin down.
Yes, maybe we need to get Kevin Baines back here to give an assessment of that.
Trust me, Kevin is busily working on this right now, and so are the ISS team as well. So apparently the pearls have been seen with the visible camera as well as the VIMS camera. So you've got these two different instruments looking at different aspects of those pearl features. But who knows? They may be gone. The storm may have removed these fascinating features just as we were starting to believe that we understood them.
Cool.
Lee, I have a quick question. What do you predict for Saturn summer, given that this storm is early?
I think, it would be unprecedented to see a second storm of this magnitude so soon after this one. And I think that the redistribution of material and the changes in temperatures that you've seen as a result of this storm may leave it such that you won't get the same conditions ripe for another plume to erupt, for example. But, crikey, we didn't expect it to happen now, so maybe things will surprise us again. I mean, who knows? But one thing is certain, is that Cassini won't be around to be able to look at Saturn during its northern summertime conditions, so we'll be becoming even more heavily reliant on the amateur community and the ground-based telescopes to tell us what's going on. But certainly we'll see the northern summer warming up, and we'll see the development, hopefully, of a strong north polar vortex, a bit like the one that you may have heard about at the South Pole. I think we'll start to see the North Pole glowing hot over the course of the next few years. And, of course, the amateur community will start to observe the hexagon that's up there in the circling the northern pole. But as for storm systems, I guess no, but I've been surprised before. So watch this space.
Cool.
Hi, this is Lee Green, Solar System Ambassador. I'm looking on slide 9, and I'm seeing that we've had the Dragon Storm, the Storm Alley. Were these at the same latitude, and were they like precursor events to this latest storm?
That's a good question. Of course, the storm that we're looking at now is up at the northern hemisphere, but the latitude is very similar. It does appear to... I don't know if you caught in one of the last slides, I mentioned that we believe that the westward jets on these giant planets seem to be more prone to storm systems like this, to creating these little eddies and little vortices that you can see down there in Storm Alley on slide number 9. So it appears that the same sort of bubbling convective motion is taking place at the same latitude in the southern hemisphere, but it isn't able to grow to such an awesome wide extent as the one that's up in the northern hemisphere. The reason for that, the asymmetry between the two hemispheres, is still uncertain. We still don't really know why. But I'm almost certain that it's the same physical processes, that bubbling up from the water cloud, which is generating those that storm alley and the dragon storm that you see on slide number 9.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is Lynn again. A similar question. The storm alley, is that in the north or in the southern hemisphere?
Well, it's in the south now because it's one of those features that Cassini was able to really get a good grip on with its high-resolution cameras. But back before Cassini arrived at Saturn, there was a campaign of ground-based imaging using telescopes mostly based in Europe, which showed that in the northern hemisphere, at about the same latitude in the north, there was again an abundance of these dark spots and vortices. So I think that the two hemispheres want to be symmetric. They want to be the same in terms of these little spots and little storms. But something unique about the northern hemisphere means that those storms generate into a planetary scale disturbance, whereas in the south, that appears to be inhibited. And it's that difference which we are really confused about. But certainly the north and south should be roughly symmetric. They should be showing the same sort of dynamical features. Does that answer your question, sort of?
Yes.
Okay, was there any more questions from anybody?
Okay, well, Lee, this was a great presentation, and we hope to hear more about the Saturn storm in the coming months as we get more Cassini observations and of course, with more amateur observations. Hopefully this is an exciting time for Saturn.
So. I think it certainly is. We're going to be working pretty hard over the next few months, I can tell you.
Yes. Well, that said, the next Charm Telecon will be held in July. We're skipping June because of some Cassini meetings that we're having, a lot of team meetings and a major Cassini project meeting will be happening in June. So we'll resume in July and look forward to hearing from our next speaker. With that, we could conclude this telecom.
Okay, thank you, Scott. Thanks, everybody, for dialing in.
Thank you very much, Lee.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone, for calling in.